Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. To find out more about our upcoming shows or access to our more than 1,500 podcast episodes, visit our website at www.biteradio.me. Today, my special guest is Chris Carter, author of The Case for the Afterlife. The evidence for an afterlife is vast, varied, and ancient, now meticulously compiled into one place. This evidence can be critically evaluated to resolve the age-old controversy of survival beyond death. Equipping you with a toolkit drawn from science, philosophy, and legal reasoning, Chris facilitates a thorough examination of the evidence and its corresponding counter-arguments. Explore compelling case studies of near-death experiences, deathbed visions, apparitions, children who remember a previous life, and communications from the deceased, with findings that cannot be explained away by fraud, mistaken eyewitness testimony, incompetence, or extrasensory perception. This book proves beyond all reasonable doubt that our consciousness endures past bodily death. Chris Carter was educated at Oxford and is author of three highly acclaimed books, Science and the Nature of Near-Death Experience, Science and Psychic Phenomena, and Science and the Afterlife Experience. He also wrote several published articles dealing with controversial issues at the intersection of science and philosophy. After working in the field of finance, Chris currently devotes his time to writing, playing racket sports, and teaching physics. For more information, you can visit Llewellyn.com and find Chris's book as well as an article that he published there. As well. So with that, I'd like to welcome Chris to the show. Good day, Chris.
Good day, Robert. Thanks for having me on.
It's my pleasure. So let's start with, when did your interest in the afterlife begin?
I suppose it began back in my student days when I was a grad student. One evening, we were sitting around, and one of my friends was trying to convince me to join him and two other grad students to spend our next year living in a farmhouse, which was owned by our college just outside of town. And I wasn't sure if I wanted to leave the student dorm, spend my second year living there, but he was relentless. And at one point, he said, the place is haunted. And well, I mean, his words caught my attention. And I basically said, well, has anyone seen anything? And he said, no, but there's been a lot of strange sounds reported. So I decided to take a hike out to see the farm for myself. It turned out to be a medieval two-story large house on very picturesque land. The college carpenter had his workshop on the property, so I stopped by for a chat. After a brief chat, I came straight out with it, and I just said, they tell me the place is haunted. He said, well, I don't know myself, but the carpenter before me, he swore the place was haunted. Well, that was enough for me, and I decided to move in and spend my second year living in the old farmhouse. To make a long story short, I did see and hear some things which I could not readily explain, and which did not fit in well with some of the materialist opinions of some of the philosophers that I'd studied, but I was open enough to admit that these experiences may be just what they seem to be, lingering disembodied presence of someone who lived in the house in days long past. Nothing I saw or heard was particularly dramatic. It certainly didn't convince me, but these experiences did spark my interest. And so when I returned to my home country, I began reflecting on my experiences, and on a trip to the library, I was surprised to discover there was an enormous volume of research and books written on the subject of survival. I was surprised by the volume of the evidence, and particularly impressive was the work of the British and American Society of Psychical Research. These societies were both founded in the 1880s. The British Society was founded in 1882 with Henry Sidgwick, who's a philosopher at Cambridge University as its first president. And the American Society was founded 2 years later in 1884 with William James, a philosopher at Harvard, as its first president. And these men recruited some of the top scientists, philosophers, scholars, historians, lawyers, and other physicians on both sides of the Atlantic, to some of the most elite intellectuals and thinkers of their time. Anyway, despite the often repeated lie that the British and American Society of Psychical Research found nothing, the simple fact of the matter is they found an enormous volume of research, very carefully gathered, very thoroughly researched. And the evidence was so strong that by the early years, 20th century, almost all of the leading members of the researchers and others, the writers, almost all of them were convinced by the evidence that we survived the deaths of our bodies, our minds survived the deaths of our bodies, including several who started off as diehard skeptics, such as the lawyer Richard Hodgson. By his investigations with the Boston medium, Lenora Piper, he became convinced that his old friend, George Pellew, another lawyer, was communicating through her, as did many of Pellew's friends and family members. So let's just say that I came to believe that the evidence is very compelling.
Yeah, that's, I think, you know, when one takes an objective view of, you know, of evidence, that, you know, it really strongly leans toward, you know, the case that there is, we survive after death. There is an afterlife. Now, in your book, you broke it down into three parts, the toolkit, the evidence, and RIP Super ESP. So can you tell us a little bit about the breakdown and, you know, kind of why you organized your book in that way?
Okay, you have to remember this is the fourth book that I've written, and all of my books can be considered as attacks on the so-called skeptical fortress. I like to use the analogy if my first three books were an armada and this one is a surgical strike. It's much more focused, it's much more brief and summarized than the other three books. The other three books can be read on their own, or they can be read, the word can be read, in a series. The first book was originally titled Parapsychology and Skeptics, and it was launched the attack on the so-called skeptics, the materialists, really, the militant atheists, who are opposed to anything that challenges their worldview. The second book dealt with the near-death experience. The fourth book dealt with other forms of evidence, such as, children who remember previous lives, apparitions, and seeming messages from the departed via human mediums. This fourth book, The Case for the Afterlife, it really puts the finishing touches on my earlier arguments, and it does so in a much more brief and concise manner. Part one, the toolkit, it gives the readers the background information, the background analysis, the concepts and ideas that they need in order to critically evaluate not only the evidence for the afterlife, but also the so-called skeptical objections. These are really based on a number of hidden assumptions. And so in part one, the toolkit, I literally give the readers the intellectual tools they need in order to understand why the evidence for the afterlife is so strong and why the counterarguments are so weak. And after that's done, part two, I simply consider the evidence, and I consider the so-called skeptical objections. I consider several of the strongest cases in five different lines: deathbed visions, near-death experience, children who seem to remember previous lives, apparitions, and messages seeming to come from the departed via human mediums. And then in part three, Rest in Peace, Super ESP, I dismantle the final desperate arguments that the materialists put forward, and that's that all of this can be explained in terms of vast, unconscious powers of extrasensory perception, namely telepathy and clairvoyance, exercised all unconsciously by these mediums or by witness to events such as apparitions or those who have a near-death experience. So I laid that to rest, which is why I titled it Part 3, Resting in Super ESP, because I'm trying to lay this, what I think is a ridiculous ideological excuse, to rest once and for all. And, you know, I mean, I think I did it, quite frankly, in all modesty.
Yes, you did. I think a person with an open mind going through and reading your dedicated and methodical approach to the reasoning and to addressing the skeptics. In your book, you have a little segment talking about the nature of proof beyond all reasonable doubt, a descriptor of militant atheists, you know, of people that are very dug in their belief system. So what would you say constitutes reasonable doubt of an individual when they're examining this topic?
Yeah, well, you raised a couple of different issues there, Robert. First issue I'd like to deal with is the first one you raised, and that's that it's important for your listeners to remember that most of these so-called skeptics are militant atheists. Now, one of the fundamental pillars of the atheistic worldview is the ancient doctrine of materialism, which simply states that all events have a material cause, and therefore the brain produces the mind. Now, any evidence to the contrary obviously threatens this fundamental pillar of materialism, and therefore threatens the collapse of this entire worldview. And this, more than anything else, in my opinion, explains dogmatic, scorched earth policy of these so-called skeptics. In other words, they vehemently attack and try to discredit any form of evidence which discredits their worldview. One of the common tactics they use, because your second issue, is the idea that, yes, there may be some evidence for the afterlife, but we cannot prove it. In the argument, which is on my publisher's website, the short essay, I should say, they asked me to write a short essay in support of my book, and I simply titled it, Can We Prove the Case for the Afterlife? And in this short essay, which can be found on my publisher's website, I argue that, as I do in my book, that the answer is yes, but we have to be careful of what we mean by proof, because there's really two different categories of proof. There's proof beyond all reasonable doubt, and there's proof beyond all conceivable doubt. And it's confusion between these two different categories of proof that allows the so-called skeptics to maintain that we haven't proved the case. Well, what do I mean by proof beyond all conceivable doubt? I'll illustrate that with an example, which is probably familiar to everyone. If A is greater than B, and B is greater than C, then A must be greater than C. It's simply inconceivable that C is greater than A. That's what I mean by proof beyond all conceivable doubt. But the only reason we can attain this mathematical certainty in this case is because A, B, and C are purely abstract entities and are purely abstract arguments. Once we leave the realms of pure logic and pure mathematics and venture into the real world, the world of facts, we can never prove anything beyond all conceivable doubt, only beyond all reasonable doubt. And what do I mean by proof beyond all reasonable doubt? Well, I argue in my book that a statement is proved true beyond all reasonable doubt when we have good reasons to believe it is true, and we have no good reason to believe it may be false. And when we're dealing with factual matters, all good reasons must be reasons based upon evidence, not reasons based upon speculation. And this is the reason why arguments based upon speculation are forbidden in courts of law during criminal cases, because speculative arguments by defense attorneys raise the burden of proof on the prosecution from beyond all reasonable doubt to beyond all conceivable doubt. Mm-hmm. For example, the defense attorneys can always argue that, well, you know, it's possible that police detectives framed my client. Well, of course it's possible in the logical sense. We can imagine the possibility that police detectives have framed someone they didn't like. Such a thing has happened in the past. But every case has to be considered on its own merits. And the burden of proof of providing evidence, in this case, is upon the person making the claim. If the defense attorney wishes to claim that the police detectives may have framed his client, then the burden of proof is upon him to provide evidence that this in fact happened, not merely to raise the abstract logical possibility and then leave it at that, because, as I said, that raises the burden of proof on the prosecution from beyond all reasonable doubt to beyond all conceivable doubt. This is the reason why arguments based upon speculation are forbidden in courts of law. The burden of proof when dealing with factual matters is beyond all reasonable doubt, not beyond all conceivable doubt. And I argue in my book, The Case for the Afterlife, that the case has been proven beyond all reasonable doubt.
In this book, this new book, you take on a reviewer of one of your earlier books saying that you use anecdotal stories in your proof of survival and that that is the weakest form of proof. Now, can you, and I believe you address the validity of anecdotal stories. So can you, you know, speak to the possible skeptic or, you know, indicating that anecdotal stories really aren't considered proof?
Well, I view much of the evidence that I consider are not anecdotes. The word anecdote comes from the Greek word anecdotos, which means an unpublished story. So as soon as the story is published, it ceases to be an anecdote and becomes a case study. What I look at are well-researched case studies. A case study is not a well-researched case study in which witnesses are interviewed and background material is gathered and all the data is very carefully and thoroughly recorded. That's no longer an anecdote. An anecdote is, you know, I was walking down the street and I saw a jet butterfly overhead. That's an anecdote. But something that's not carefully researched, not carefully backed up. A case study is nothing anecdote. And the cases I consider are some of the strongest cases ever. These were thoroughly investigated, sometimes by lawyers who hired private detectives, trail mediums who took them to foreign countries to see if they could still replicate their impressive work, which they did, by the way. These are not mere anecdotes. These are well-researched case studies that I consider.
Yeah, the idea of it, the origins of anecdote being unpublished stories, you know, versus case studies really does make a distinct difference.
Case studies are widely used in business schools, they're widely used in medical schools, they're used in law academies, you know, to train legal law students. Case studies are widely used. Because they're considered excellent learning tools, and they're very solid and reliable. It just depends on how thoroughly they've been researched.
I agree. So early on in the book, you address the idea that Christianity is compatible with the idea of evidence for survival. And can you talk a little bit about that? Because it seems sometimes that the dogmatic beliefs of Christianity sometimes mask or are used as reasoning against the idea of an afterlife.
Yeah. I argue in my book that this modern evidence is thoroughly compatible with Christianity, the words of the ancients. I think that modern revelation and ancient revelation complement each other. You know, some people refer to the Old Testament and say, you know, based on certain words in the Old Testament that seem to prohibit necromancy, you know, communication with deceased. But in fact, there is a case, King Saul, I believe, he consulted a medium, which in earlier versions of the Old Testament is referred to as the Witch of Endor, and the New International Version, simply the Medium of Endor. And this medium summons the ghost of a prophet who tells the king that on the next day he will die in battle, which happened the next day. No commentary is offered on this. And so in several passages in the New Testament do not seem to prohibit such communion. For example, at one point Jesus tells his disciples, believe not every spirit, but test the spirits to see whether they are of God. Now, if there's no reason to suppose that the change called death suddenly transforms bad people into good, then, of course, it's wise to test the passages, test the spirits. And then, you know, in another passage, Jesus refers to false prophets. And he says about them, by their fruits you shall know them. Now, the author Miles Edward Allen commented on this passage, and he wrote, and I'm quoting him here, if the results of a spirit communication are alleviation of grief, enhanced compassion, reduction of anxiety, a feeling of being closer to God and other such positive feelings and actions, then what role could the devil be playing? What sort of demon goes around encouraging folks to love one another?
Makes you wonder, doesn't it?
I'd like to expand on that just a little bit, if I may.
Okay.
All right. It's also important to remember that we talked about the British and American Society of Psychical Research. Well, several of the founding members and active researchers were clergymen and theologians on both sides of the Atlantic. One prominent example would be the Reverend Charles Drayton Thomas. He was a Methodist minister and an active member of the British Society of Psychical Research. He participated in many sittings with renowned mediums. He came up with the innovative method of proxy sittings, in which a third person who does not know the departed, knows nothing about them except their name and their date of death, will visit a medium as a proxy sitter for a person who is interested in contacting this departed person. This rules out telepathy, of course, and unconscious cues between the medium and the sitter.
Mm-hmm.
Reverend Thomas came up with this idea of proxy sitting in response to a challenge from a skeptic, who basically said that, well, you know, it's possible that the medium is simply following cues provided consciously and unconsciously by the sitter, or perhaps that the medium and the sitter are in somehow telepathic communication. The medium is just, in other words, reading the sitter's mind. Well, with these proxy sittings, the successes continued all the same, and the critic was forced to admit that he was wrong. Anyway, Reverend Thomas wrote this: "Perhaps it will be asked what benefit may be expected from a general acceptance of this evidence for survival. I think it will do for others what it has done for me. It has supplemented and reinforced my faith, both in times of bereavement and in the prospect of old age and death. Also, it has further emphasized the value of personal religion." And I could go on and on about this. There are other Catholic priests and theologians who see no contradiction whatsoever between ancient and modern revelation.
Yeah, you know, and for the people who have that, you know, strong religious belief that it is forbidden or just, you know, work of the devil, that kind of thing, to recognize that, you know, it has been accepted throughout the centuries by theologians. And so now, one of the things that, you know, in the second section of your book, you talk about the evidence. I'd like to talk about just a couple of those examples, just to give the readers an idea of what's contained in them. And one of the lines of evidence is the near-death experience, or the NDE. And in your book, you cite a study that indicates that more than 300 million people worldwide have experienced NDE. So other than just the sheer number of reports, what makes the NDE such a strong case of survival in the afterlife?
Well, near-death experience is one of the five independent lines of evidence that I consider, which all point in the same direction. I don't think that the near-death experience is the single most impressive line of evidence, but, I mean, several features of it certainly do strongly suggest that we survive the best of our bodies. The near-death experience often involves reports of the individual leaving their body, accurately observing resuscitation efforts from above, meeting departed friends and relatives, a life review, sometimes meeting a mysterious figure of life who guides them, on a life review, and other such matters. And these are all, in the best cases, these experiences give every indication of occurring at a time when there's every medical reason to believe the person's brain was either severely impaired or entirely non-functioning. In other words, incapable of generating any sort of conscious experience. This is further evidence. The mind is not the product of the brain. The brain is a receiver-transmitter for the mind, a two-way receiver-transmitter, sometimes from body to mind, as in sense perception, other times from mind to body, as in willed action. So, and this idea is supported not only by near-death experience, but also by terminal lucidity, in which people with brain damage or severe cases of Alzheimer's suddenly become lucid in the final days, hours, and minutes before they pass on. This is well known. So it's not even necessary to invoke the near-death experience to refute the idea that the materialist idea we discussed earlier, that the brain produces the mind. I think even mainstream medical evidence indicates that simply isn't true. The brain is a two-way receiver channel for a non-physical mind.
Yeah, and you know, that old idea of the brain as the repository, you know, of memory, and when the brain ceases to function, so do all of the storage that was contained in it.
There's never found memory traces in the brain. They've done experiments on chicks and octopuses. They've taught them a new task and removed large sections of the brain. The animals still remember how to do this task. There's also, in cases of memory work in which is lost because of injuries to parts of the brain, more often than not, the memories eventually return, indicating that the memories are not lost and that they're not stored in a physical location, or not only in a physical location, perhaps. So I argue in my book, it's not even necessary to invoke the so-called paranormal to disprove the materialist idea that the brain generates the mind. Now, the brain is the instrument of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
I like Wilbur Penfield. He's a renowned brain surgeon, Canadian brain surgeon. He won the Nobel Prize in medicine because he had surgical work with epileptic patients. Now, he started off determined to show how the brain generates the mind, and after his research, which won him the Nobel Prize in medicine, he came to exactly the opposite conclusion. He used the analogy of a computer and a programmer and a computer. He argued that the brain is a sort of biological computer which was programmed by a non-physical mind in order to handle mundane tasks. And we all know this, because think about learning a new skill, how to drive a car, how to play musical instruments, how to play a new sport, what have you. In the beginning, it requires a lot of conscious effort. We have to think about everything that we're doing. But once we learn how to do it, then we can do it almost without thinking. And it frees up we programmed our brains in order to free up our conscious minds to think about other things, such as, listening to music on the radio, or talking to a passenger, or thinking about what we're going to do when we get to work, or thinking how we want the music to sound. We want it to sound happy, slow, lively, or where we're going to place our next shot when we're playing sports. So yeah, Penfield argued that the relationship between the mind and the brain is that of programmer to biological computer.
Yeah. Now, one other of the evidence topics that you include that I want to talk before we run out of time is the idea of apparitions. You know, you indicate in that particular section that, you know, this is something that has been experienced going back centuries in the ancients, and also indicated that there was an Icelandic study that 14% said that they had seen an apparition, and then you also cite that there was a survey of Charlotte, Virginia respondents to a survey that 7.5% had said they had seen apparitions. And I, you know, took note of that, Charlottesville, Virginia, because I have some very good friends from that area. And also, it's also been a site of, you know, many of my guests. So let's talk about apparitions. Now, first of all, this is a much lower percentage than, you know, for example, the NDEs. And part of that, I think, is what my experience is that I personally had seen an apparition that I would probably end up being joining them, you know, on that side of the veil, because it's just one of those things that is, for me, kind of a fearful type of experience. So can you talk a little bit about the idea of apparitions and whether they, you know, if there's any particular way to identify or maybe would give rise to someone seeing an apparition?
Well, you know, apparitions typically described as looking just like a normal person, and so much so that they're typically mistaken for a living person. They may cast a shadow, be reflected in the mirror, and if more than one person sees the apparition, then each person will see the apparition from the proper perspective. Having said that, in many other respects, apparitions do not resemble living persons. because they may appear and disappear in locked rooms, vanish suddenly, or pass through physical objects. But a prominent characteristic of that person's the dead is the high frequency of persons who died violently. There was a researcher in Iceland, Eric Haraldsson, and he found that 30% of his Icelandic cases involved encounters with persons who had died violently, which was almost identical to 28% frequency of violent death found among 19th century British cases researched by the British Society of Psychical Research. Collectively perceived apparitions are not as uncommon as you might think. In cases in which apparitions are perceived, a British fellow named Frederick Myers, he found that in two-thirds of such cases in which more than one person is present at the time, more than one person reported seeing the apparition, and from the correct perspective. Some of the cases that I mentioned are extremely well-researched, very thoroughly, and some of them are reported by people who reported the case to the British Society or the American Society because it was contrary to all their beliefs. In other words, they were diehard skeptics, materialists, who did not want to believe that what they saw was an apparition of a departed person.
Yeah, you know, the idea of a collective perception, you know, the idea of more than one person seeing and that person at the same time, same location, to me it would seem that that then adds more validity in a way, that it's just not an individual experience, that it is, that it can be experienced by more than one individual. To me, it seems it makes it more believable.
Yeah, and I also mentioned cases in which animals share in the experience. One such case was reported by an American naval officer. He wrote a letter to the American Society of Psychical Research, and he reported that, have I got time to read a bit of his letter?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was, I found that, you know, about that animal perception as well. When I lived in San Diego, I had a cat who, we had a huge wire cage that took two people to move. One time I was sitting there with my cat, the cage moved, you know, without any kind of, you know, wind or no perceivable reason for the cage to move. The cat looked at that, and then its eyes and head just seemed to follow something. So to me, it was reading about the animals and their perception. It seems that not only would they be able to see apparitions, but also, you know, what is beyond our range of sight.
Yeah. Anyway, if I could just read the letter to the American Society, this naval lieutenant, he wrote the letter in 1927 when he was stationed at the Naval Powder Factory in Indian Head, Maryland. Anyway, he wrote, "Early in the following March, I was sitting at a card table in the den, solving a problem in navigation. I was facing the front of the house. The time was about 12:25 a.m. Both dogs were sleeping on the floor at the end of a davenport in the living room. I heard the spaniel growl, but as he often growls at the marine sentry as he passes the house, I paid no attention to it. Both dogs then got up, passed me in the den, and went down the back hall in the dining room, where both dogs again growled, and then tore madly across the hall and up the stairway. The noise they made going up the stairs awakened my wife, who was asleep on the second floor. Surprised at their actions, I looked up from my work and saw a man standing in the living room near the hall archway. He was probably 22 feet from me. All outside doors and windows were closed. I could see him plainly. Now, he did not recognize the man as the employee of the powder factory. The officer stared at the man for about 10 seconds, and as the stranger seemed to speak, then the officer rose from his chair, took a few steps forward to greet the man, at which point the stranger vanished. He carefully searched the house, and he saw that all doors and windows were closed. He concluded he'd been seeing things, but then again a few nights later, in excellent light, the lieutenant writes, he was alone in the house about 9 p.m., and he again saw a man standing in the living room. He wrote, "As I entered the den from the back hall, I saw the same man standing in about the center of the living room. The distance was about 20 feet, not more than that. The light was excellent, and I could see his features plainly. I was not in the least frightened. Again, he seemed about to speak, and again I waited, this time probably 15 minutes. I took about two full steps toward him, which brought me within 15 or 16 feet of him at the most, when again, he wasn't there. He described the man. He weighed a little over 200 pounds, dressed in light gray clothing, had a deep tan, gave every appearance of being solid. And go on, about 10 minutes later, he visited his neighbor next door. His neighbor's wife came into the room, and her husband told him, the lieutenant seen a ghost they don't recognize. So at this point, the woman put about 20 photographs before the lieutenant and asked him to look through them. So the lieutenant goes on in his letter. He wrote to the SPR. He writes, I shuffled then through carelessly, and at about the seventh or eighth picture, I came across the portrait of the man I had seen a few minutes before. There was no doubt in my mind as to it being the same man. I would know him among a thousand. Dumbfounded, I said, this is the man. Who is he? She replied, my father. He's been dead for several years. About 10 days later, he saw the same man again in the kitchen under good light. And this is how he concluded his letter to the American Society of Psychical Research, the naval lieutenant. I am willing to swear the truth of the above statement. I hope there is some simple explanation of all this, as I would hate to have my lifelong faith in a ghostless world shattered. My parents taught me from childhood that ghosts did not and could not exist, and all my life I have firmly believed that to be true. Naturally, the beliefs of a lifetime are hard to shatter. Hence this letter, seeking an explanation of that which to me is inexplicable. Very respectfully, yours, the lieutenant. So there's no process. It's hard to imagine how this could be a hoax or a misperception. And again, animals shared the experience too. So this is only one of several cases of apparitions, which I discuss in my book, The Case for the Afterlife.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Chris, this has really been a delight speaking with you and talking about your new book. I enjoyed reading it. It is very concise, very easy to read for people out there who have an interest, either, believing in the afterlife or those who may be even skeptical, even especially those who are skeptical. You know, it's a good book to read to at least prompt curiosity, I would say.
Yeah, and, those who are interested can always consult my reference as well, because everything's carefully referenced.
Yes. Yeah, that's what I like, too, is that people can just go to the bibliography at the back of the book if they want to explore further from which you derived your information. So this has really been a treat, and I want to thank you. And everyone, again, today, my special guest has been Chris Carter. We've been talking about his new book, The Case for the Afterlife. And again, you can find out more by going to his publisher, Llewellyn's website, llewellyn.com, and just type in author search, Chris Carter. Also on that page, you can read the essay he wrote, Can We Prove There Is Life After Death? So everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.